is the last somewhat... Well, that's well, find out after this week, let's see. The last somewhat serious debate of the year, the motion is this House believes liberal feminism has never ditched its racist roots. Yeah, this is going to be fun to share, great. But before we get to that, we have council announcements first. So does anyone have any council announcements they want to share? Yes, go for it.
Okay, so this week I'm not harassing you to sign up for next week's motions. As you've seen, it says Christmas mini games, so please come next week for the wee Christmas jump around. I recommend tonight to give you an example for some fun mini games and also the Christmas dinner. If you're not signed up for the Christmas dinner, don't worry, you can still come to the Christmas mini games, they'll be held beforehand. And you will all be getting involved. There's nothing, no pressure, it's just fun one-on-one type mini games. So there's no like crowds or like conversation from the whole department. But it will be good crap, and I have fun all, and I put money into it. So please arrive, because I don't work a bitch, and I actually put money into this, so please. Second off, also, next term card is being decided. Tonight, after debate, there will be an Excel spreadsheet put up on the Instagram and Facebook pages for you to give suggestions for what you want to see next term, what you want to debate, and what you want to see on the term card. You can either write it as a way to write motions, like this House believes, this House regrets, or you can just give a general topic, because I might be retaking them anyway, just to work for what fits better due to my debating experience. So we'll be having that form put up on Thursday, today, after debate. There will be a meeting on Teams, so no matter if you're going home after this or whatever, there'll be a meeting at Teams next Monday at 7 p.m. You can all come along and vote and find it out for what debates you want to see. So you can debate over what debates for next year and party and we'll take votes. So you all have involvement in what we debate next term, so it's not just me putting things I like on it, which I didn't do this year either, so yeah. So yeah, that's all.
Thank you. Yes, you've got a very important one. Go for it.
So, yes, obviously a number of you will sign up for the Christmas dinner that we're doing next week after the mini debates. So if you brought 20 quid for that, please give it to me. And if you don't have 20 quid tonight, you can send it via bank transfer. The deadline for getting it to me is Monday at 5 p.m. And also if you paid me and then need to drop out, do it before Monday at 5 p.m. But if you're late, I'll have to liaise with libraries about whether we can get a refund for it. So hopefully we can, just so it's a little looking background or something like that. And then what else do I have? I also put up the membership monitoring survey, which has some interesting results so far. About 40 odd people have filled it in. So whether you have attended one debate this semester or all of them, please fill it in, because I can then break down the data by regular attendees and what. Anyway, so as many people fill it in, the more people fill it in, the more representative it will be of what the demographics of the site actually look like, and that's important to help the council see who's underrepresented within the society and take steps to address it. So yeah, those are the two forms for me, and you can find the form if you've not filled it already on our Instagram flyer.
Thank you. Any further council announcements?
I actually have another one. Because I've literally just flown back from London from a work trip and my phone's nearly dead. So if anyone has an iPhone charger, can you please get it? It's all down there.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
No worries. So it is my absolute pleasure to welcome our Emperor himself, James Watson H. Lamb, standing in for Secretary this evening to take the minutes from last week's debate. Just give James a massive round of applause, please.
Okay, so this is never going to happen again, so enjoy it while it lasts. On the 1st of December 2022, the Queen's University Belfast Literary and Scientific Society convened for the 11th ordinary meeting of the 174th session for the exciting motion, "This House would make language learning compulsory." It's a good thing that much of this was written by Josie, as I don't remember a thing from the debate because I wasn't really listening. As usual, the meeting began with announcements. Ellie Byrne unsurprisingly announced something about the Christmas mini debates taking place on the 15th. Ryan Hulley then went on to announce the Christmas dinner taking place in libraries on the 15th at 8 p.m. For the eagle-eyed among you, these are taking place on the same date, suggesting that they're happening one after each other. After agreeing with the minutes, the meeting then moved on to private members' business. Dermot, the Donnybrook bandit, Hamill, presented the emergence of the Christmas market in Belfast, with the price of pints being raised to £6. Before this debate, I looked online, and apparently the price of a pet rat is up to £25, which, if one were to create sort of a rat to sterling exchange rate, would suggest you could buy potentially up to 4 pints for just one rat. Just think, you just release a pet rat, and nobody, you'll hear the screams of people. What more would you not want? He then asked the House whether this was acceptable, considering the cost of living crisis. Responses were heard from Ellie Byrne, Harry Shaw, Keira Swale, and James Orchard, HLM, and Jack Hammond, and Jack Money. I'm sure we can guess what half these people said, because, of course, they say the same thing every week. Then we went on to President's questions. Oh, joy. There may have been a question about breakfast, but I'm just not going to mention it. Noah Barnley then asked the President who he wanted to win the World Cup. Mafi responded by saying he wanted anyone except England to win, preferably Scotland. Thus, we can see that this is an example of the cold house for unionism that we see. Guest chair professional Margaret Topping, like all good guests, remaining impartial, gave her first speech to the House. She first thanked the House for the invitation to the debate, likely regretting this after hearing President's questions, noting that the motion was quite close to her heart. Funny that, it's almost like she specialises in that subject. A vote of prior opinion was then taken. There were 22 votes for the proposition, 12 for the opposition, and 5 Alliance voters. A majority of 10, or in other words, if you lived in Fermanagh, that'd be a landslide. First on the proposition was Jack Hanley. First, Jack began by proposing that language learning should be mandatory at the GCSE level, given the same status as STEM subjects. Having grown up in a bilingual household, Jack saw a direct beneficial impact of speaking Irish had on a sense of community. He argued that bilingual children, as you said, students there, have a wider capacity in terms of academia, as most working class children don't have the same access to language learning. This is every element of class divisions. Once again, Marxists spouting their bullshit rhetoric. Then, first off, on the opposition was Terence Metcalfe. Terence stated that he was a victim and survivor of compulsory language learning. Who isn't? From his own traumatic experiences learning Latin, I can empathise there, Terence expressed the shame he feels whenever he hears the language being used today and cannot understand it. He argues that we must draw the line in making language learning compulsory, giving students the option to opt out of language lessons to focus on other skills. To be honest, it didn't matter what Terence was going to say. His mere presence in the opposition probably meant that they were going to win, regardless. Second on the proposition was Harry Shaw. Harry began his speech by addressing the House in French. He also stated that he felt great regret for not being able to speak French, having asked Keira Swale, HLM, to translate the sentence for him. In doing so, he effectively drove a car through her arguments. Go on, laugh. Harry argued that this was up to individuals to pursue a language and to practice it, yet how can we expect young students to see it as necessity? He stated that the world is continuing to shrink because of globalisation, making language learning even more important now than ever. Secondly, on the opposition was Keir Swale, HLM. You know, they give those out to everyone these days, don't they? Keir presented her experience of teaching English in France and the way in which she fought with resistance from students not wanting to engage in the language. In this case, she couldn't focus on the students who genuinely wanted to learn English, because this was a common problem faced by teachers. This is perhaps more of a statement on her ability to teach than French children in general. I don't care, she's not here. I can make as many jokes as I want. She stated that GCSE students would not be likely to pursue language learning into A level, as they do not see the benefit the subject will have for their career prospects. Third in the proposition was Jake Kieran. He rated the proposition's arguments that language learning should be elevated to that of English and maths. Jake cited the ways in which knowledge of foreign languages helps to provide a view into your own culture, as the English language is made up of borrowing other languages over centuries. According to this logic, one has to learn every other language in Western Europe to have contextual information on English, which sounds like a lot of fun. Finding a way of seeing how foreign language influences our own language means that language learning can be of natural importance. Third in the opposition was Tulsha McSparran. Tulsha stated that language learning is not for everyone. Despite the high rates of languages spoken in mainland Europe by their residents, they have the advantage of being exposed to multiple languages from a young age. She concluded by saying that You can take a horse to water, but you can't force it to drink. In the same vein, you can force a child to go to a language lesson, but that doesn't mean they'll learn. That is, we can all see here, Tulsa thinks children are expendable animals. Unsurprising. Unsurprising considering how many siblings she has. I showed this joke to her before the debate, and she stated, quote, "What does it matter? A woman can have like 20 kids in her life." The final speaker for the proposition was Dermot the Rat Whisperer Hamill. Dermot began by stating that we are trying to teach kids German, not sending them to gulags, which doesn't even make sense because gulags were in the Soviet Union. And I should say, for the German consulate that might be listening in, that was a joke. And again, the Germans. He argued that neurological studies show that bilingualism is beneficial in terms of multitasking and other functional skills. He stated that the system is broken and should instead be reformed to make language learning more accessible and practical. The final speaker on the opposition was Ellie Byrne, HLM. Ellie argued that there should be an opt-out system for students who do not enjoy the subject, and instead, subjects such as history, RE and sociology should be compulsory. This is correct. They proposed that through an opt-in system for language lessons, classes would be smaller, allowing the teachers to focus on their pupils and increasing their grades. Ellie, as a Marxist, of course, is factoring costs and money into this situation. Well, that doesn't matter to me. The vote on speaker ability took place with everyone clearly voting based on speaker ability and not their own personal preferences. There were 5 votes for the proposition, 32 votes for the opposition, and 2 abstentions. So the opposition had it. In percentage terms, this is about as competitive as an election in West Belfast. May I take the minutes as read?
Can we give James another massive round of applause? And it is now our pleasure to turn our attention to private members' business. For this evening, so this will not finish. This debate will not finish on time. There's so many things that are going to happen that we'll just. I'm just going to go with it. Okay. Yes. Private Minister. Yes. State your name for the minutes, please.
Noel Barnley. I was looking at BBC News yesterday, and I was looking that Doug Beattie was getting slated by the DUP for allegations of sexism because he referred to someone as screaming and crying like a little girl. I wonder if the House agrees with me that it's really funny now that the DUP decided to purchase him with a bit of misogyny.
Any thoughts on DUP, Doug Beattie? Any female thoughts on? Yes. Say your name for the next, please.
I think it is, but I have to further like the DUP calling out misogyny or sexism in the first place. But I think it is important that whenever it does happen, or it's pretty much to anyone, that we should have a critical eye and we should be saying that it's absolutely disgusting. Like Doug Beattie in Depressionism, this isn't the first time he has said sexist remarks. I'm all about giving people chances and not a cancel culture. Educate people, he is from a different era. But he's a politician in this era, and he is meant to be representing constituents now. He has been given multiple opportunities to learn. He has been told from the last time that this speech came out that it was not okay. He was given a chance, and then he went and he reverted back to his ways now, he's saying, whinging like a girl, which is just absolutely ridiculous. It was more interesting work on the soft post radio.
Yes. State your name for the minutes, please.
Ellie Byrne. obviously, with Doug Beattie, I have met him a couple times because I've been cadets and stuff, and my experience with DUP and UP with being, like, at the time identifying as female, and being one of the highest ranked cadets, especially at Steve Hall, doing, like, all that kind of stuff, typically DUP wouldn't even speak to me, including higher up members, not even Foster did, but current members who are the leaders of DUP refused to speak to me because I was a woman. They're like, I thought you said this was a high shot cadet, and they're like, that is, and they're like, looking at me, and for sure I am. So I don't think they have a ground to stand on for calling out someone else's sexism when I've seen firsthand their sexism with my own eyes towards myself, but whatever. I do think they should still be called out, and Doug Beattie, like, as well, was one who I've met, and whenever the tweets came out, it really disappointed me, especially, not that I'm pro-Orient in any way, I'm not, but obviously, a situation I don't think that, that he said that women are suited for the army when he, like, one of his tweets was about like, women not belonging in the army and stuff like this, when actually, when he was meeting cadets and meeting female cadets, it was the exact opposite of what he was saying to them in person before the press. So that really swung me at the time, and now to see doing it again is not a surprise, and I think there needs to be some more accountability, or just in terms of realisation of how sexist current unionist parties are, because it's a disappointment and they're losing their own votes for it.
Yes.
I think the reaction from Edwin was less so as a party thing, and the other fact that Doug's tweets were initially uncovered because of what he said about Edwin's wife. He insinuated that Edwin's wife worked in a brothel and very much attacked Edwin in all sorts of societies. And I think Edwin took this very personally and took it in the assembly because I think he was very much in a position to call it out because he'd very much been on the receiving end of it. And just generally, the atmosphere in the assembly changed when Doug said it. I mean, we were up there for the day and talking to every MLA we talked to, DUP, Sinn Féin, I talked to some of the Alliance ones, I mean, our associates were putting 2-point orders about it. There was very much an entire attitude of the assembly, including from UUP politicians who were just disgusted and disappointed in Doug. But at the same time, while it's disappointing, it's not shocking. I mean, we've all seen the horrific stuff that he's tweeted over the years. You know, Alacrity just doesn't change its spots. It's in the case of Doug Beattie, because he hasn't changed, he's had plenty of opportunities, and it's just a powerful force for Doug Beattie.
Yes, seeing him for the next week.
I originally, when all the tweets came out last year, sort of defended Doug on the basis of, well, you know, give someone a second chance, and he was, like he was setting out a score. The big problem he faces, I think, is that he was setting out a score for the UUP that is, we're more inclusive, and we're, you know, this, that, and the other. And then it comes around to the election, and he puts up Tom Elliott in the Manor of South Tyrone against, what's the name, Rosemary?
Rosemary Barton, yeah.
Yeah, and so he lost the UUP's only female rep, so now he's got 10, well, 9 now, MLAs. All male, and then comes out with this remark this week, so it's not looking good for the Union of People. And yeah, I guess it's one of those where it's just like you can give someone a second chance, but it's kind of like what Edwin Booth said, is that you can accept an apology, but you can't accept apology after apology after apology if you don't actually change your behaviour. And I think that's pretty spot on in the sense that obviously there is a question about the DUP's social policies, how that interacts with, you know, misogyny, as it were. But the from the Politics Society event last year, I'm speaking to Edwin Booth. I think he's someone who genuinely takes like attacks on his family like very seriously. And I remember talking about like his growing up and the experience that his mum had with, I can't remember what it was, but she had a rough time and stuff like that. So I think there was a reason why he took it so personally and why it went down so badly. And I think Doug Beattie needs to stay on script a lot more if he's going to not go off script, because that was written down in his notes.
Any final comments on this one, or any alternative points on private reservations? Yes, same here for the next week.
Jodie Morrow, HLM. So as someone who is the biggest fence sitter at Llywelyn, who also comes from South Armagh, I was really, really disgusted this week at what was revealed about the Alliance Party and their treatment of Jackie Coad, who is the first person I ever lent my vote. So Jackie is absolutely lovely, and already you could tell wasn't getting much support from the party in terms of trying to get her seat because of the optics of Newry and South Armagh not being big for fence sitters. But it's come out that there was some sexual harassment within the party by older male colleagues, and it wasn't taken seriously, and she's now resigned and left the party as a result. So I'm absolutely disgusted, because Northern Ireland already had some very bleak choices, and one of the ones that I've been going with has just really sincerely let me down. So what does anyone think about that?
Yes, student information, please.
As someone that worked on Jackie's campaign, Jackie's someone I consider a very good friend, and she was the first person I voted for, and I'm not an Alliance voter under any circumstances, really, but Jackie is. Jackie is someone that, having talked to her, I don't really believe in politicians. I'm an interviewer. I like to tear politicians apart. Jackie is someone who I genuinely, every time I sat down with her, every time I talked to her on the phone, she genuinely gave a fuck. She cared. And most people, like, you talk to a lot of politicians in Northern Ireland, and they just don't have that spark the way Jackie did. And from watching her campaign, and watching the way that party treated her, it was at least five different women that made comments, that made allegations, and made reports about that party leader, or that party member that she left over, and the party did nothing. They didn't investigate it. They simply said, Naomi Long was aware of it, and I can say that now entirely truthfully, because I heard from a very senior source in the party that she kicked the same member out of the campaign and vetoed any work he had involved in it. He consistently kept party members down that were female. The treatment of women in that party, particularly in the nearing Armagh branch, was absolutely disgusting. And the Alliance parties, the fact that they essentially remained silent on the issue, they should hang their heads in shame because of the treatment of a woman that is a genuine face in politics, that is much better than any politician I've ever worked with, ever interviewed, ever spoken with. She is miles ahead of all of them. There is no one in Northern Ireland right now, in my opinion, that can hold a candle to Jackie Coe because she gives a fuck, and no one else does in seeing where Jackie Coe did, and the way that party treated her is absolutely disgusting.
Thank you. Just on a personal point for me is that Jackie was probably the first person that actually had done a hell of a lot for me too, in terms of the stuff that I've got onto, the opportunities that I've had, as someone who dealt with a lot of online abuse and a lot of stuff like that. Jackie was one of the only people that actually spoke to me and went and had coffee with me and had, you know, was genuine, as you said, a really genuine person. It's not a political point, it's just that as a person, she's absolutely fantastic, and it's really, really damaged me. And from speaking to her over the weekend, what she's been through has been awful. Any further comments on this? Yes, state your name for the minutes, please.
I just think the Alliance Party needs drawn out as well. They stand over and provide the rights of the Girls Act. They've like been spearheading essentially going through, and yet they've been allowing this to happen over the same. It's so typical of everyone who's on in this country. You know, we're doing one thing with service building, like we're just allowing this insidious monster to exist, and it happens in every part of our society, but the fact that it's been swept under the carpet, like you say, it's disgusting, and it's disheartening for a woman in this society to see it happening, you know.
Do you have a point to do here?
Oh, no.
Do you have for the minutes, please?
Jack, I just want to add on that point, but I completely agree with the term machine. And I think it speaks to the wider systemic issues with the way women are treated in politics in Northern Ireland. Something you may or may not know, but my mother is a elected councillor in a majority party in the NI, and the treatment that she's received from that party and from members of other parties as well, from her time where she took office in 2016 to now, has been fucking disgusting. There's no other word that I can put it, even from within her own party. It's, and especially in that area as well, because she was part of the council for Mary, and it's just, it's horrific. It's a boys' club. There's no other way to put it. And the only way that I can possibly conceive that this type of issue is solved, I don't think this is just an alliance issue. I think this is an issue in the UK, I think this is an issue in the UP, and I think this is an issue especially in Sinn Féin. It is, and SNP as well, but it is. It's revolting, and there's no other way to put it. I'm hearing about this. This is actually, I'm not afraid to admit it. This is the first time I've heard about this specific incident now, and I'm actually just, I'm angry now, just as angry as I was that this is just, I just keep hearing stories like this. It's awful.
Thanks very much for sharing that. I'll take one more point of primary business if anyone has anything. Yes, state your name for the minutes, please.
I mean, it's been raised on some of our personal accounts about the issue vote. I know council, we've had our own just general discussions over our opinions on it in general. But the SU recently had a vote about getting rid of the welfare officer and replacing it with a climate officer. Now, I'm not about to go on a political rant about my own views, but as someone who a lot of us know is very eco and green in their political views, but also introduce the welfare officer to this society. I am disgusted that in a cost of living crisis, in a crisis of mental health, in a crisis of sexual assault on this campus, they try to get rid of the welfare officer. I mean, it's been raised by others as well that, you know, there is an issue with some SU campaigns in the fact that they try to promise stuff that they don't have any means or way of doing it to get our votes. And as someone who grew up in a disenfranchised political area where we were promised one thing and never given it, it is extremely annoying and patronising to be given this, we're going to do this for you, we're going to do this for you, and then they get in and do fuck all. I've seen it my whole life and it annoys the life out of me. And for them to call themselves a student union and not be a union for the students in any way whatsoever is absolutely despicable. I mean, that £400 payment or 100 yards like extreme per wasn't even done by then either. Like, that was a political party outside of Queen's campaign on it. It was actually the SLP, so there's one good thing for them, but like, I don't mind the SLP, but like, this is what I mean. Like, the student union didn't even do that themselves, and it's just so frustrating, and I can't believe that it was narrowly voted away. Like, that was our welfare officer. That is for yous who have shitty landlords, for yous who can't afford to eat, for yous who can't afford for our deadlines, for our mental health support. You know, this mental health awareness campaign, we're all aware of mental health. We all have mental health issues. We're well aware of it. We need the support. And it, as you can see, it's something that angers me a lot. I'm not in any way discreet like that, but it's one of the houses that begins other students. What do you think?
Thoughts on this topic? Yes, stating in for the minutes.
No, Barman. It speaks to a greater trend that we see in politics across the entire world. People in positions like the ones that they're in, they say one thing and do another. It's so fucking melting. We need better.
Cheers. Stating in for the minutes, please.
Jack Hamlin. I like Ellie. Also, all political beliefs that are very down. I'm saying quite being explicit, but for me, what's baffling about this is that I don't see how a planning officer and a welfare officer are mutually inclusive. I may be missing something here, but I don't understand why one needs to leave in place of the other. Why can't we just have both? I think they're both.
It was a separate decision. So there was one decision about getting rid of the welfare officer, and there was another decision about making it a climate one. But it was kind of entangled in a certain way where it was looked like it was one or the other, but in reality, it was probably two separate decisions that were made, from my understanding. But if you go for it,
But at the end of the day, I feel like there should be protectorates in place for both of those officers to be in place. I understand maybe they need to be separate decisions, but in all honesty, in terms of like my opinion on both of the policies within doing politics, there should be protections in place that both of the positions are protected, because I feel like they're absolutely integral, and I feel like they should be in this modern planet integral to any type of organization platform. There should be, especially with regards to the student union, there should be someone obviously that is taking in climate issues, because in my opinion, all of our politics are kind of issues, but there also should be welfare anywhere. There should be welfare in within anybody.
Just as a clarification, I want to fill in with apologies.
Well, I have to take it, so yeah.
the idea was to merge welfare and equality into equality and well-being, which would, the 3 points would do would be organise its campaigns on equality and diversity issues, organise its campaigns on student well-being and welfare issues, i.e. student finance, accommodation, cost of living, and challenges inequality within the university. Alongside that would be a community and climate officer who would create a campaigning spirit in the union and support the organisation's student-led campaigns, developing an inclusive and diverse sense of community among students, maintaining contacts with external works, trade unions, community associations, good community relations, residents in South Belfast, and campaign, and with also campaigns and initiatives related to environmental activism and sustainability. Also point out that as running for student council, I was able to promise that I would tackle the cost of living, mental health, and I believe the climate crisis in running for a first year representative, and that was an entirely acceptable manifesto for a first year. You know, that's what I was able to promise, and I got elected on it. So, no.
Yes, state your name for the minutes.
Jodie Morrow, HLM. I think that the whole thing, like, it's just a baffling argument, because the SU, before even trying to alter these rules, does a terrible, terrible job, as Ellie said, of even representing its students. And I can speak for Ulster and say that ours is just as bad. Like, I've actually went to our welfare officer about harassment on campus, and they ended up letting the whole thing go because the guy complained about his mental health. So they do absolutely fuck all for their students. They just want to make sure that as many people get through the first as possible, make themselves look good, and continue funneling the uni with money. So I don't think it's shocking at all that they don't give a shit about welfare, and they probably don't give a shit about climate change either. They just say it because it's cool and it's, you know, the party line at the minute that we should all be involved in it. So yeah, I don't think there's any substance to issues in Queen's or Ulster. It's just like all of our political parties, they say one thing and they do absolutely fuck all behind the scenes.
I'll take one last point on this. Yes, state your name for the
next,
please.
Are we ever...
State your name for the next, please. Thank you.
I never stopped talking, so just keep there. Like, are we ever actually happy with the ESU? I'm sorry, but have they ever actually done anything beneficial other than very, very small things? They are funded. They're the only UK SU that was funded by the very thing they're meant to stand up against and say things are going wrong. Of course, they're in the pockets of Queens. They're literally not moving to anyone. Then you have people who run for it who are egomaniacal. Because all they're doing then is there for a year or a little bit less. Put something onto their CV so they can very quickly slip into an office somewhere or slip into a political seat where again they do nothing for anyone. So no, I have a very cynical view of the SU, even though I have an academic draft. I would do nothing for anyone, so I can speak from personal experience. No offense to anyone who's in the SU, but a shout and you don't shout.
Oh, sorry, yes, I'll take one more. State your name for
the
minutes,
please. Daniel Toft. I think that the fact the SU are holding emergency council meetings to discuss the rearranging of titles and roles for themselves during a cost of living crisis, amongst everything else, tells you everything you need to know about the SU and how it's run and the people in it and how unsuitable it is for like modern students and just, you know, all the problems we have, and they're discussing moving titles around for themselves and reorganising themselves to better fit their CVs. It's just absolutely mind blowing.
Thank you. So it is now, thank God, the last president's questions of this term. So if you've got a question, you can put your hand up now. Yes, you do have a yes. We've got a few here, okay. We'll go here first, because I know what this is. Go for it, James. State your name for the minutes, please. For yourself.
Mr. President, have you acquired some weaponry?
Right, for those of you who aren't aware, we're in the Christmas spirit here, right? For those of you that went to the Dublin trip, that James is incredibly, I think, insecure about the fact that the Phil has a sword and we don't. But I would like James to come up to the front of the room for a second here, because I have acquired a literific sword. Neil James. So there's the weaponry that you're so keen for. that wasn't included in the price. Why was that so quick?
It was.
Yes, state your name for the
Donald. Mr. President, in line with the traditions of this society, what did I have for breakfast this morning?
I had Weetabix for breakfast this morning.
That's a fucking lie.
Mr. Hamill, I would be very careful with what you're saying here.
Mr. President, that is a lie. I know for a fact that you went to French Village and you had chips with turkey, bacon, and pigs in blankets.
That was my lunch.
For breakfast?
I'm not denying that. I had lunch with him, not breakfast.
You very specifically told me that you did not have Weetabix before that excursion.
Any other questions? Yes, Steve, let's please.
When you go to your family for Christmas, do you have Baileys or do you have
ice? Baileys. My family don't drink, so but I don't know. Yes, Stuart name for the minutes, please. Well, I, you know, quite like my career. I quite like as everyone knows, I'm incredibly popular with the SU officers, so I think that's an incredibly good idea. But I would rather be skinned alive than ever stand for SU elections, so I think that's probably probably not going to happen. Apologies. Any further? Yes? So,
can I ask that? I can't hear you. On the point of the sword, which I believe looks like a cavalry saber, according to my expert here on my left, have you done any research on yourself in Ancestry.com? Have you found any ancestry of German birth? Would you accept to be
God.
Or is there anyone else in this room who would supplant that place, in your opinion?
What was the end? I didn't catch the end of that. I heard Weichstag.
If you were not Kaiser, is there anyone else in here who you would take to do that job? Well, or are you a half-star
Matthew? What is happening? Well, it would obviously be James. I think he would want to be Kaiser or anyone, so he can have that title if he wants it. hopefully there's no more and we can move on.
No. Why is it so cold in here?
I don't know. It is actually really cold in here. Okay. So, thank heavens that's over. Before we have the wood carpet, I would like to welcome Roisin Haine from the Feminist and Equality Society, who is very kindly co-hosting the debate with us. So Roisin, you have the floor. Thank you very much.
So for those of you who don't know me, I'm Roisin Haine, and for those who do know me, I'm very sorry. I'm going to start off tonight with telling you that I do have a huge secret, in fact, to open up tonight with. It's important. I am, in fact, a huge feminist. I know you didn't know that, but I'm also the president of the Feminist and Equality Society, so I'm very glad that we're doing this collab tonight so that I can advertise for as much as I want for the next 2 minutes and not get a gavel thrown at me, but I can do it to you. Thanks very much to the Literific for reaching out about tonight. It's a subject very near and dear to our hearts, the Feminist and Equality Society. We have three key aims for this year, and education is one of them. Debate is essential to education. You learn about other people's viewpoints, but you can learn more about your own opinion. And I think it's very important for those of us who are involved in activism, not those in the SU, to employ critical thinking, but those of us who are involved in actual activism to employ critical thinking. Good job Aidan Moran isn't here. but we at the FemSoc have a very strong opinion on tonight's matter, not to diss this side at all, but liberal feminism was founded on racist roots, and it has not ever ditched its racist roots.
Thank you.
Are you asking me?
Yeah,
need
no,
happen.
There's no questions in this.
No,
it's a clarification. Well, you said there's three things, but you've only mentioned once.
Oh, I didn't want to go through my entire thing. It's empowerment and enjoyment as well, but I didn't think it's.
I'm not really.
No, I'm empowering myself to meet Kathy's later. We believe that tonight's motion, we're very much in the proposition side of it. It was founded with racist rights, and it never ditched its racist rights, and it's very important because we are a group of people from different ethnicities, different backgrounds, that we recognise that. There is power structures in our society that need dismantled, and they're used for the oppression of people. Gender is one of them, but race is 100% another one, long class, etc. But that's not valid for tonight's argument. Good fucking luck to you, lads. I wouldn't want to be used. But so glad for once that I'm not the only person to be talking about feminism at the debate, so I'm looking forward to this, but more so to my bottle of whiskey waiting for me, so thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we have another huge round of applause for our Russian team? And now it is our time to turn our attention to the vote on prior opinion. So this is your own personal perspective on the motion, which I believe will be pretty one-sided, I think, but we'll soon see. So if you think that feminism has not ditched racist roots,
ignore my vote for
now. Liberal feminism has not ditched racist roots. You can put your hands up now.
Ignore my vote.
Well, I'm not ignoring it because it's prior opinion.
Is it everyone?
No.
If you think it has ditched its racist roots, you can put your hand up now. Oh dear. Oh dear. Am I going to ask again? If you think it has ditched its racist roots, you can put your hands up now. No, keep right voting. If you're an Alliance voter, you can put your hand up now.
Seven.
So, James, do you have the numbers or do you?
No, she told me all time as well.
Okay, so according to my reliable source, there were 28 votes for the proposition, an astounding zero votes for the opposition, and seven Alliance voters. So I think the proposition has narrowly won it tonight.
Yeah. It is my great pleasure to welcome the first speaker for the proposition tonight, Miles. Give him a big round of applause.
Alright. Cheers for that, Rasheen. That was a great setup for us. I'm literally blind, so see if I like start stumbling over words and all, it's because I can't see a fucking thing up here, so. Sorry. So, Mr. President, proposition, opposition, members of the House. Liberal feminism emerged as one of the earliest waves of feminism, popularised by thinkers like Wollstonecraft. It was designed to work towards women's liberation within the existing power structures of liberal democracies and through a process of gradual change as opposed to revolutions. I would argue that women's liberation can never be successful so long as we work within political systems that are sympathetic to capitalism, colonialism, and the patriarchy. So I'll try and explore some pros and cons of liberal feminism so I can show the House why they should support our motion that liberal feminism never ditched its racist roots. Now I have to admit, trying to come up with anything good about liberal feminism was pretty difficult. It got us the vote, I guess. Women's suffrage didn't translate so swiftly into black women's suffrage. And it got us a weak kind of descriptive representation of women across political and public institutions, which basically means we got some white women into power, and a lot later we got some black women into power. To put it simply, that's about all that liberal feminism has achieved in its history. It doesn't take much thinking on this, however, to discover that these achievements don't really mean much by the way of substantive representation of women. At present, only 26% of seats in national parliaments are held by women. And if we look to the methods used by liberal feminism to bring about these things, we can see a much larger issue that undermines much of its work. It achieves descriptive representation by teaching women that the way to solve their problems is by taking on characteristics of white men. Instead of promoting feminine qualities, it seeks to erase them, as well as erasing any other characteristic that doesn't serve whiteness or white maleness. This is obvious when we look to previous female prime ministers and presidents in liberal democracies across the globe. It brought us lots of white women, like Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady, yeah, good, who kept a cabinet of almost all men, appointing only one woman to cabinet, Baroness Young, a so-called enemy of gay rights. It brought us Theresa May, woo, no, who was in the news more for discussion over which pair of kitten heels she was wearing than her actual political policy, with one article entitled In Memoriam to Theresa May's Spectacular Footwear, stating the best part of Theresa May's premiership has arguably been her shoes. While I agree that Theresa May was not the best at her job, we would never see the premiership of a male prime minister reduced down to his shoes. And let's not forget Hillary Clinton,
the lifelong bestie of Israel and America's number one girl boss, who lobbied for the three strikes and you're out policy, which would see repeat offenders given life sentences if they'd already been convicted for violent crime. Also in the 1990s, she spoke about her husband's 1994 Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Bill, implying that African American children were super predators without conscience or empathy. Given that the black community make up so much of the demographic of repeat offenders due to issues resulting from systematic racism, it doesn't take long to realise that Hillary is no friend to black women. Moving on. Even after putting aside the obvious issue that we still have a long way to go before proper descriptive representation of minority groups is realised, there's an added condition placed on women from minority groups, which in almost all cases they must meet before they can achieve these positions. That condition is material privilege. Let's take Kamala Harris, for example, the first woman, an African American, to hold the position of vice president. This is of course something to be applauded, but this achievement is somewhat diluted by the fact that her own privilege and wealth of opportunity is the reason she was able to assume this post, conditions which definitely do not reflect the rest of her community. Her father was an economist and professor at Stanford, and her mother, the daughter of an Indian diplomat, was a cancer researcher. She grew up moving between the United States and Quebec, took lessons at a fine arts college, and ended up attending Howard University, a world-renowned historically black private university. Also, even when women from minority backgrounds achieve positions of power, this does not mean that they will represent the interests of their community. Many, unfortunately, actually end up assimilating with the oppressive class and leaving their own communities in the dust. An example of this is Nuri Martinez, a former member of the Los Angeles City Council. She's a Latino woman who was recently in the news after there was an audio leak from a meeting where her and her colleagues made horrific racist comments about fellow members. She can be heard calling one of the members' sons a negrito, a Mexican-Spanish equivalent of the N-slur, and a changuito, meaning monkey. So now to dig into some of the flaws in liberal feminist theory. Liberal feminism is inherently white-centric and unproductive. It forces women to assimilate to existing overarching power structures like the patriarchy and capitalism, or else they'll never be able to achieve power and liberation. It promotes women's rights through the lens of white women's discrimination, of which there is little, and uses language like gaslight, gatekeep, girl boss, in order to give women something to strive for without actually doing anything productive for women's liberation. I would argue that all of these examples show one of the main issues with liberal feminism, that it can never eliminate class issues, something which is inherently tied to race. It perpetuates capitalism, leaving women from the working class with little to no opportunity for upward mobility. And considering the fact that minority groups make up so much of the working class, capitalism disproportionately affects them. Therefore, if we cannot erase class, we cannot liberate women. What I would propose is socialist intersectional feminism. Intersectional feminism is an ethic that benefits all. It asks not just for descriptive representation of non-white actors, but substantive representation, allowing actors to be meaningfully engaged in political institutions and make notable change. It strives for equity rather than just equality and the elimination of capitalism as well as the patriarchy. This is the only way forward for women. So to conclude, not only has liberal feminism failed to ditch its racist roots, it will never be able to move beyond its racist roots. It is an outdated ethic that needs to be replaced with intersectional feminism. Real feminism is intersectional. It's for black women, Muslim women, trans women, disabled women, people who don't identify as women but identify with the struggles of womanhood, and it's even for men. It's for all people, and it's only by engaging in feminism that involves all people that we can achieve real change. Thank you.
Pleasure to be up here today. So for context, for anyone that hasn't ever spoken to me, I am an absolute raging feminist, much like Roisin. I'm just not as fortunate to have as much education on feminist studies and feminist politics. So it took a lot of research for me to actually understand what we were debating tonight. And Roisin has very kindly helped me simplify it for my very dull mind. That liberal feminism, I believed until tonight, because of the research that I did, which is clearly not that good, that liberal feminism, I believed, was intersectional. Roisin has thus corrected me. So, liberal feminism can be explained basically as believing in equality whilst I've got the cold, by the way, so really my brain's not working. Whilst intersectional feminism is more about equity, whilst liberal feminism is about equality. So liberal feminism, I'm not here to defend it in its entirety and say that it's the best form of feminism, to say it's the one we should strive to. It's not what I believe in, and it would be a disservice to this motion. This motion is about race, and there's no denying that liberal feminism and most feminism has racist roots, because feminism was born in a racist society. Feminism has been going for over 100 years. If you start it in the first wave with suffrage, that was 100 years ago. And there was plenty of racist suffragettes, we can't deny that. But we can still celebrate the achievements that they did make. Although the progress is slow and it may not be the revolutionary way that we would love to have equality just forced upon society, we would all love that in this room. However, that is not realistic. We as women experience inequality all the time, and we understand how hard we have to push against these systems. And as much as we'd love to completely overthrow the system, that's not always the way we can actually do things. Liberal feminism is born out of a system that has oppressed women and has made things incredibly difficult. Yes, women have fallen into certain categories, and we've tried and tested things. Feminism has waves because we're constantly trying to work out the best way to do it. One of the current wave has so many different lenses, as Roisin has explained to me, one of them being liberal, one of them being if I could remember the bloody word, intersectional. I keep thinking exclusionary, I'm like, it's the opposite of that. There's all these different scopes of feminism, and as a feminist, I do not agree with every single woman that identifies as a feminist. There are so many different bubbles. There have always been different subsections of feminism throughout history, throughout every single wave. I'm sure there were suffragettes who were not outwardly racist and weren't outwardly trying to keep people of colour from getting suffrage at the same time they were getting it. But unfortunately, there are those racist roots, and liberal feminism, although it isn't targeting specific issues like sexuality and race and classism in the same way that intersectional feminism is, which I do believe is the right way to do it, liberal feminism just presumes that by tackling issues, the overarching issues of feminism like FGM, like abortion rights, I'm struggling to come up with things now, I've literally written them down, I can't even see. Sexism in the workplace. Aye, that's a good one. It presumes that if we try to tackle all of these issues, it will naturally benefit every woman and every man and every person of every gender identity, because it believes in just very basic gender equality, and it believes that if we tackle all these issues, we're naturally going to tackle these things as well. It is not discriminatory by default in this current day and age. It may not be actively targeting issues of race in the same way that intersectional feminism does, but that does not mean that it has not tried to detach itself from its racist roots. We can celebrate the suffragettes for what they did achieve while still acknowledging that they did something wrong, and what feminism has moved in waves forward. Second wave feminism, from my research that I did, which you might criticise, second wave feminism was whenever we started talking about bodily autonomy. We got the vote and we were like, yes, fuck this, we're going to do some more. We're going to get some bodily autonomy, and we're going to... what was the other one? There was two main things and I've completely forgotten them. It was actually, before being defined like that, was sort of the start of intersectional feminism, where they realised, we can't just do this with middle class white women, we're going to bring in more people. And third wave is girl bossing it, which I really hate. So third wave was like, oh yeah, we've got this in the bag, we're going to reclaim our sexuality, we're going to reclaim all of these slurs, even though I don't want to call anyone a bitch, but you can do it if you want. Fourth wave feminism was whenever we realised, whoops, we've still got loads of things we haven't tackled, we maybe need to take a step back. And fourth wave feminism has bred all of these wonderful subsections, such as intersectionality, which, you know, as a feminist, I do not agree with every subsection of feminism, but I do believe in every woman's right and every person's right to speak on all of these issues and hopefully take a stance that does benefit everyone. I would rather they were doing that. But back to the motion. liberal feminism, to say that it never ever ditched its racist roots, to suggest that liberal feminism has never progressed, which completely is antithetical to the definition of liberal feminism. Liberal feminism has progressed in society. It was born in a very much more racist society, in a society where misogyny was much more overt. We have come on leaps and strides, the fact that the women in this room are able to vote, we are able to access the pill, we've been able to do so many things now that we take for granted, because and we can now look at it through a lens and say, these middle class white women were doing things a bit silly, you know, it was a bit daft at the time. But we are in a much more privileged position, and we have to remember that when talking about feminism, we're talking about a group that, you know, may not acknowledge other forms of oppression, but is born out of a situation of oppression itself. And therefore, we have made mistakes along the way, but we as modern day feminists have so many things that were born out of all of these other movements, which everyone in this room should be very, very fucking grateful for. And it is our job to, it is our job as feminists in the modern day to look at all the ways that have passed, look at all the issues that we've tackled and all the ones that are still yet to be tackled. Things such as maternity and paternity leave, looking at sexual assault, how we can broaden it out, how we can understand how the patriarchy is making it that all victims of sexual assault feel unable to come forward, looking at things like, you know, our institutions like the SUs and our universities, which make it really difficult to come forward about sexual harassment. All of these things are linked to feminism and have been improved through feminism. Feminism has racist roots. To say that we have never progressed and never made any strides to move away from that is very reductionist and does complete disservice to every woman who has ever been a feminist in the last 100 years. Not all of them are completely perfect, but no woman is, no human is. That's the point of feminism, to give every woman a platform and to carry on pushing things forward. Please vote for the opposition, even if it's a pity.
Speech quickly by addressing something in the minutes. I am not a Marxist. I am a queer eco-socialist, and you can unpack that for the rest of the day and figure out what that means. So, with anything as controversial as this, I want to make two statements first. First of all, I am a fella, so if I am wrong on anything, I genuinely, like, please POI me and let me know, just because I don't want to be speaking out of my place. Also, I'm going to start it with a very bombshell statement that I'm going to explain as I go through. So, this is it. The call for intersectionality in white social justice circles is seen by those circles as an assault of the liberal ego. So, me being a medium to large sized hairy man, it's only right that I start this speech at all by elevating the words of a woman who's a lot smarter than I am. So, in an article by activist Rachel Cargill, she describes the uncomfortable interactions that she had with white liberal feminists in the wake of the murder of Nia Wilson in 2018 in Oklahoma. So, these women, Cargill recounts, who she claims had things in their bios such as social justice warrior and intersectional feminist, in her own words, took the call for solidarity that the black community placed on them as a personal attack, as opposed to a call to action, as opposed to a call to solidarity. In my view, always taking offence to a call to action or to a call to solidarity is a confirmation that no matter what it is that you're doing, you're not doing enough. If you feel attacked by someone asking you to lend your voice, to lend your privilege, to leverage that in order to raise someone else up, I'm sorry, you're not an activist. If you feel that that's an attack on you personally, there's steps that you need to take to address that. In a way, I feel it's a necessary attack. If you were to categorise it as attack, I think it's a wake-up call. For too long, the focus of liberal social justice has been on reward and self-gratification, without considering the truth that sometimes it aids in the perpetuation of what it purports to oppose. By engaging with liberal activism, you are, I'm going to get gavelled for this, but you're wanking yourself off. Thanks, James. It's exactly, it's very, and I'm not saying that these are inherently negative things to do, but it's very easy to post the infographics. It's very easy to place the event times on your social media. It's not easy, and I'm not pretending that it is easy. It's not easy sometimes to go to these things. It's not easy to get your arse down there and show your support. But this is what we have to do. This is simply the reality of it. Women of colour have also been fighting for the right for equality for generations. Why are we ignoring them? I don't wish to say this in a way where we're bringing in the voices of women of colour so that we can, for the betterment of feminism, to use that, you have experience with inequality, tell us what we can do and then we'll fuck off. Because that seems to be the prevailing sentiment, within liberal feminism. No, these types of things, why must the fight for gender equality and racial inequality be mutually exclusive? Why are these two separate struggles? I feel that they're inherently interlinked. Maya put this a lot more aptly than I did in terms of their tie back to capitalism. I ask you this honestly as well. When you think of the most prominent figures of Western feminism within, say, the Hollywood sphere, how many of them realistically are white? Realistically. If you think to mind the first five, it's a pretty staggering majority of them will come to mind. And that's I feel not inherently at fault of the average activist. I feel that that's just, that is the sort of society and this is the sort of reality that liberal feminism produces, because it does not raise the uncomfortable. It seeks to perpetuate what already exists. So Western feminist icons are predominantly successful white women, once again, as Maya put very aptly in bringing up my absolute bestie, Hillary Clinton. Liberal feminism, in my view, seeks to support privileged women who, within their societies, have also profited off the colonialism of the Western world. I'm not saying that gender violence and gender disparity doesn't exist in the Western sphere. It absolutely does, but we need to remember about a lot of the countries and nations and societies and cultures that were left behind in the wake of colonialism in terms of feminist ideology. So a good example of this that I feel is apt is in the UN Women Count Programme, that's a tough one for me to get through, found in 2020 through the National Survey of Violence Against Women in Uganda and Girls, or women and girls in Uganda, sorry, it found that almost all Ugandan women and girls had experienced physical and or sexual violence by the age of 15. By almost all, I'm not speaking figuratively, I'm telling you that on the statistics, it's 95% of girls in Uganda before the age of 15 experienced some form of sexual assault from someone they were with in a relationship or not. How is this issue aided in any way by more white women in power in the Western sphere who continue to do nothing with their influence outside of confirming their image and the white socialites who it benefits? I think Margaret Thatcher is a fantastic example of this. White sympathy, as well, does not manifest as a genuine concern for the disenfranchised. It never has, in the same way that I have felt myself through heterosexual sympathy for the queer struggle. It's an insecure plea for the alleviation of guilt. They want to be told, oh no, you're not one of the bad ones. You're clearly with us. You've clearly read the literature. But if you do nothing, you're not with us. If you're not standing next to us, you're not there. They give nothing or little to the movement except pandering and empty support. Oh yeah, no, anytime. If you're struggling, you can speak to me. But whenever it's time, whenever we need the numbers there, you're not there. Liberal feminism, in line with the democratic privileges as well, afforded to white people for generations, believes that results can be achieved by asking and waiting for permission within bureaucratic societies, as in forming a political activist group that lobbies, that works through due democratic process by placing these women in power. This is not and never has been an option for people of colour. This is simply a completely unequal way of viewing this, because if you think about it in terms of engaging with the democratic processes and the bureaucratic processes, there's a significant advantage that white people have. I don't think that that's even a controversial point to make. I think that everybody in this room is well aware that if you are white running for election as a woman, you will have more success than a woman of colour in the same position. So this as well is put very aptly, I feel, by Professor Ron Monagall Bryan. I'm really sorry if I've pronounced that wrong. Following the election of Donald Trump in the US in 2016, she said, "You now worry for your children, your family, and your brothers and sisters. We have been worrying for years." In my view, to commit a detrimental action against the singular race is racist, but it's equally racist to stand by and do nothing when something can be done. This is liberal feminism in regards to race, pretending to do something while nothing tangible has been achieved. Thank you very much.
Mr. President, members of the proposition, members of the opposition, members of the House, it's a pleasure to speak in front of you all this evening, and we've really been thrown to the lion's den with this one, and that I'm up for a challenge. I will say, all of us on the opposition signed up late to this, so please be nice to us. It goes without saying, racism is evil. It degenerates society and is totally and utterly destructive. The first wave of feminism, starting with the suffragettes, was absolutely middle-class white women campaigning for their right to vote before people of colour, like in the United States, for example. But in the research I did, I learned an interesting historical fact that I think James Orchard will appreciate, that there's historical evidence for a black man voting in England, and the election took place in 1744. His name was Ignatius Sancho. The debate title has previously been discussed on whether or not liberal feminism has ditched its racist roots. The very motion itself proves the point of us, the opposition. If there was no attempts of steering away from the racist roots, then we've made no progress in the last 100 years, and I think we can all agree that's just not true. There would be no point in debating the motion, and the motion would instead be something like, this House believes feminism needs to be anti-racist.
On that point?
No. A prominent liberal feminist speaker, Rebecca Walker, who casually the proposition didn't mention, she's a third wave feminist and one who coined the phrase third wave feminism. And I'll read a quote to you from her because I found it quite impressive. She was the one that actually coined the phrase third wave feminism. She said, to be a feminist is to integrate an ideology of equality and female empowerment into the very fibre of life. It is to search for personal clarity in the midst of systemic destruction, to join in sisterhood with women whom often we are divided, to understand power structures with the intention of challenging them. Rebecca Walker is a prominent example of a third wave feminist, like I just said. Her achievements include the creation of the Third Wave Fund. It was started in 1997 for the purpose of giving women across the United States grants for education. And there was a wee small election in November in 2016 in America. I don't know if you heard about it, but there was 4 times the amount of requests given for grants. And she's possibly one of the most notable liberal feminists beside the likes of Hillary Clinton, who the only good thing I will say about her is I'm glad she's a feminist. Walker talks about feminism and racial identity as well because she is black and Jewish, and her writings reflect the experience she has had in America as someone with a multiracial identity. Liberal feminism has rejected its racist roots because it is an umbrella movement. There are varying schools of thought, neoliberal feminism, libertarian feminism. The best way to differentiate liberal feminism is that liberal feminists want to reform society in a gradual sense and not do it through rapid or revolutionary means like the proposition explained. A key difference between liberal feminism and radical feminism is that it is more pragmatic. Liberal feminists have emphasised building far-reaching support for feminist causes among both women and men, and among the political centre, the government and legislatures. In the 21st century, liberal feminism, although slowly, is taking a turn in towards embracing intersectionality and an intersectional understanding of gender equality. And modern liberal feminists support LGBT rights as a core feminist issue, although I think we all agree, fuck TERFs. Worth it. Liberal feminists typically support laws and regulations that promote gender equality and ban practices that are discriminatory towards women. Mainstream liberal feminists, particularly social democrat feminists, support social measures to reduce material inequality within the liberal democratic paradigm. Whilst liberal feminism traces its origins back to the first wave, the broader ideological section includes other waves, especially third and fourth wave feminism. Institutional groups like UN Women, who work to promote gender equality and the rights of women and LGBTQ people, they urgently call on communities and governments around the world to stand up for LGBT rights. The Association for Women's Rights and Development supports LGBT rights and opposes the anti-gender movement, and has described trans-exclusionary feminists as Trojan horses in human rights spaces that seek to undermine human rights. They also said that anti-trans activity is alarming and that sex-based rhetoric misuses concepts of sex and gender to push a deeply discriminatory agenda that trans-exclusionary feminists undermine progressions on gender and sexuality and protection of rights of marginalised groups. So even the UN are saying, fuck TERFs. To be worth it again, I don't care. To be clear, while there are debates, UN Women is a liberal feminist organisation, and as evidence, they do seem to acknowledge the varying degrees of intersectional feminism. Women still evaluate, or UN Women that is, still evaluate gender equality in each country by looking at how integrated women are, or how they're integrated into hegemonic society. For example, how they measure men and women, or how they measure how many women are in a position of CEO and or politicians. Like that goes, that references obviously to the old meme that liberal feminism is just more female, insert things here. Liberal feminism, like I said earlier, is starting to acknowledge intersectional feminism, but bad actors exist in every movement, and it's unfair, bad faith, and extremely uncharitable to describe liberal feminism as still the same as it was 100 years ago. It's evident that the society we live in is not the same as the one that predated us. I challenge the proposition and push back on the claim that liberal feminism is still racist today. It's patently untrue. I hope you vote in favour of the opposition on this motion. Thank you very much.
I had a lot of dropouts this week, so thank you to all of you for signing up last minute and doing me a huge favour, and I'm sorry. So let's get started. Okay, this house believes liberal feminism never ditched its racist roots. Now, the definition of liberal feminism and some of the key differences, I'm going to get up my sociology A-level notes, which I had to study different types of feminism for, and I got an A in. So I thought qualified to say this. Okay, so one of the main differences in liberal feminism and intersectional feminism, as we on the proposition are, is that the explanation for gender inequality, by this is the definition under liberal feminism, what they define as, the explanation for gender inequality lies not so much in structures and institutions of society, but in its cultures and values. This means that liberal feminism, after getting the suffrage for women's rights to vote and abortion rights, unlike here, they believe that that work is done and it's all about socialisation and rules, which is important. However, whenever the institutions we live in this society, if you look at the US, the police in the US were actually reformed, not changed, they just changed the title, because the police in the US used to be the slave catchers. They didn't change that system, they didn't edit that system, they stuck a new name on it, kept the star badge and changed the name. And that's the police department in America. That structure was created to oppress black people, and that structure, as we can see, is still oppressing black people. Under liberal feminism, they do not have an issue with that structure, and therefore kept its racism. No, thank you. Second of all, feminism in the media has already been addressed, as liberal feminism is quite typically white women, middle-class white women, and inaccessible. Now, at back to structures. Thing that with intersectional feminism is really important, and in my general political view, is that we have separate structures of society, separate structures of inequality in society. If you want to get rid of the sexism pillar that is holding up our current society, you cannot leave behind the class pillar, the racism pillar, the anti-disability discriminatory. You cannot leave behind the homophobia pillar, because those will still stay, and the roof, the foundation of our society, will stay intact. You need to tackle all of the pillars at the same time. Because my experience as a non-binary person who is AFAB, I have had the experiences of a woman. And Maya put it so greatly, that I am not a woman, but I identify with the struggles of womanhood. Because I have been oppressed because I'm a woman, and I have been oppressed because I'm non-binary, and I have been oppressed because I am extremely working class. Those three things are integrated together in different ways. They are not separate ways of oppression, they are integrated. And that is why liberal feminism will not help me. They'll look at me and be like, oh, you're a white woman, fantastic, ignoring the fact that I'm not a woman, that I'm not able to have the same opportunities of money to be able to get a paid education to tutors to get into those lifestyles. Now, the second thing as well, and it's liberal feminism, as I said, back to the institutions, this is a key definition here in this debate. One of the reasons why, as I said, liberal feminism typically has this view that there isn't much laws or structures that need to be changed. However, mortality rates for black women in the UK in childbirth is 4 times the rate of white women, even when those black women are middle and upper class. Did you know that medical textbooks do not include photos of rashes, skin burns, or skin conditions of darker coloured skins? And that is why there is a black mortality rate so much higher than white. Because even in medical journals still today, taught in Queen's University and in Britain, says that black people do not feel the same amount of pain as white people. I mean, you can genuinely look it up. It is disgusting. There are so many things in society that are systematic, that are institutional, that need change. And simply going on and saying that, oh, we need to change societal attitudes is not enough. Do you know that if I want to get a hysterectomy, I can't have kids. I will never be able to have kids. I physically cannot, right? I have a medical condition. I have medical conditions that I need to get tumours out. The thing is, if they take out my tumours, they take out my ovaries. That's a hysterectomy. I'm not allowed a hysterectomy until I'm 24. And on top of that, I have to have my father's written permission and my partner's written permission. My boyfriend, who I've been dating for 5 years, he gets to sign off on if I get my ovaries removed because he might want to have kids. Despite the fact that I have no eggs in my ovaries, I do not have a functioning cervix. My area has been through menopause 3 separate times and I'm in agony, and I am not allowed one until I'm 24 and my dad and my partner get more of a say in my bodily autonomy in this country than I do. It's disgusting. And that is why we're on the side of intersectional feminism here today. I mean, recently, we all know about abortion rights in Northern Ireland and how inaccessible that has been. Did you know if there was a slim chance that I could get pregnant? I have been before and I miscarried. If I hadn't miscarried, I would have needed an abortion or I would have died. I wouldn't have been able to access that here.
And I'm sorry, that was a very, very grim topic, and I'm sorry for not giving a trigger warning. I really should have in retrospect, so sorry guys. But that is why I'm on this side today, because it is an emotional debate, because it's our lives at stake. It is half of the society, more than half of the society's lives at stake, because the other thing is, feminism and sexism and the patriarchy do not just affect people with vaginas or people who are femme presenting or AFAB people or women or whoever identifies in that kind of general area. It affects men as well, because the patriarchy was a system made by men that pushed all feminine qualities to the side and said they're awful. That talking about your emotions is a female thing. Crying is a female thing. Mental health issues, sure, get a stiff upper lip, just stick it and just go. The reason why men have worse mortality rates in jobs is because those are the men jobs, those are harder jobs. That's why men are more likely to die at work. The reason why men die at war is because men are stronger, men are tougher, they should be fighting in society. That was put in place by men, and that affects men. The reason why male suicide rates are so high is because your condition, the feeling emotions, being in tune to your emotions and talking about those, which should be healthy and normal, is a female thing, and it's seen as weak. The patriarchy affects us all, and it's not just the patriarchy. The patriarchy works hand in hand with the class structures to keep us down, with the racial structures to keep us down, with every single part and every single way they can fragment us apart and discriminate us in different ways. They work together in a mesh that pushes us down. And the only way we can change it is not tackling one thing at a time, it is taking it all together. The other distinction between liberal feminism and intersectional feminism is that liberal feminism does not believe there needs to be a systematic change or revolution. Intersectional feminism does. Because what on earth can we do? Structures that kept us down by tweaking them and changing names will not help us anymore, but give us a false disillusion that our chains have been removed when they have not. And that is why I'm on this side. Thank you.
Face this. I didn't sign up for this debate. Start whenever you want.
Speak on this side, by the way, guys.
Like,
he's all the lost mates.
I did not sign up for this debate. I certainly did not sign up to sit on this side. I just need everyone to know that before I go into this. And that also sometimes in the Queen's University Belfast Literary and Scientific Societies, we say things that we don't mean. And Ellie, that was really not nice what you just did to me. I just look like a right bastard. Oh yeah, they're far away if you want, because it's only going to prolong my agony. So.
7 minutes.
It's revolutionary socialism. It's always fun. So, whenever I was researching this debate, it goes, what's liberal feminism? Then I googled it. Really awful, apparently. Then I googled what radical feminism was. Apparently it's Cuba. Then I googled what being a woman is. Look at Harry Potter. Then I went on Twitter and someone called me nasty names. So then I went back to radical revolutionary Cuban socialist feminism, which was interesting to see. Far away. So as I looked at Cuban socialism and Cuban feminism, and looking at its links to racism and how Cuba is described as this attempt at a feminist revolution, and I thought, wow, that actually sounds really cool. And then I looked and I was researching how it dealt with racism and how Cuba really dealt with intersectional feminism and how it dealt with racism within feminism, and just doesn't, does it?
Okay, just because international feminism was not incorporated by Cuba, therefore, and makes it racist, doesn't therefore make liberal feminism not racist. So give back to the ocean.
Well, actually, I fucking want this game after this, and a lot more than that. The issue is, with that point, Rashi, arguing the motion, absolutely, it doesn't just mean that liberal feminism isn't, but the alternative offered is, doesn't really seem to work much better, does it? Because it is offered in Cuba.
No.
No.
Is it?
Yep. Is it you? I love you in the eyes of the
face. Well, no, you're allowed to say it to me as long as you clarify the point.
That's not the motion. The motion is liberal.
This is not a point of clarification, so I'm going to have to cut you off because I've only got limited time and that's not a point of clarification. So if we're talking semantics, Roisin, let's talk what a point of clarification is. But the issue is, that is the alternative offered by the opposition, or by the proposition. It isn't working. So as much as liberal feminism is absolutely awful, and I'm not going to try and say how great it is, because it's not, the alternative isn't much better. Also, Jack, you brought up Uganda, and you brought up the plight of women in Uganda, and you actually, I think you brought up the joint programme on gender-based violence in North and Northeastern Uganda, if I'm not mistaken. And you brought up about how, now feel free to correct me, that the ignorance of Western white women towards that kind of plight and everything that was happening over there, and kind of how the West has ignored that. Yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah, I wasn't saying ignorance, I was saying inaction.
Inaction.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I think the issue is that when it comes to the specific joint programme, which is, I don't think anyone can really try and say, isn't trying to deal with the issue or isn't trying to do something, bar, you know, intervention, which really obviously works when the West intervenes in other parts of the world, as seen in Iraq and Bolivia and everywhere else. I mean, the issue with that example is the fact that it's led, that its main donor is Norway. In fact, its exclusive donor is Norway, and is being actually headed up by Mona Jewell, a white woman who you will find if you look into her, if you've ever seen the play Oslo, she's very interesting. And yes, it's very obviously having a fucking clue what I'm talking about. Fair enough. Worth it. I'm a fucking notion what I'm on. So, my friends, the proposition has offered you an alternative. The opposition does not try and defend liberal feminism because it isn't great, to say the least. It hasn't dealt with the structural issues in the way it should. But what we do say is that by completely ignoring what liberal feminism offers, is by doing so you ignore everything that liberal feminism has done. What liberal feminism has done is not good enough. I do not say that it is. It isn't. But what we offer is the idea that it could be. And we hope that at some point it will be. We do. I hope otherwise I've really mistaken what everyone's saying. But we are trying to offer what liberal feminism is promising. Rashin is ready to cut me. I feel like I will need that. Possibly an Armalite or six. But by ignoring everything liberal feminism has done, you're putting... No. You're ignoring everything that has possibly done by feminists right across the world. I mean, the alternative offer doesn't work. It hasn't worked. In... No. It hasn't worked. It isn't going to work because any time we've seen it practiced, it doesn't work. It hasn't worked. So while we do not say that liberal feminism is perfect, we believe it's come quite a long way from the days of white middle class women in England and Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, well, Ireland actually back then. Long live Norman. Long live partition. By doing so, you ignore the progress we've come. And yes, I know I am a man standing up here and lecturing everyone on feminism. I do appreciate the irony, but I ask that I ask that we don't ignore the plight and the work of every woman that has come before us and even every male feminist, and I really do want that whiskey. I ask that you don't do so. I ask that you look at the work that every feminist, both liberal and radical, has done. I ask that you try and look on the bright side of liberal feminism, and I know I've talked some waffle today. And if you ever want a lesson absolutely waffling for 7 minutes, you're welcome. Talk to me in the pub, and by fuck, I want a pint.
Thank you, Jeremy, for that
speech. We have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to intervene and not take any questions. So we're going to go straight to...
Yay! No, I'm planning for them to... I want to get something to drink.
What?
Is it quick round question?
No.
It's not going to be quick. It's going to be like 10 minutes per question. No. I'll take one abstention...
Can I take a question just
for fun? One abstention question only. What, if anyone has an abstention question, they'll take it now. Yes.
What are you as current members of the Feminism Quality Society?
No. Yes.
I don't see six white people here talking about race. Have any of you consulted any black people or black liberation groups?
I quoted a black woman.
No, like a consultant. Okay,
this is why I said this is a bad idea. Proposition to respond first.
For our side, personally, for me, I can't speak for anyone else, but yes. I am in the University for Black Lives Matter that is still alive in Belfast, feminist movements and community group movements in Belfast that go against discrimination of anyone. I also volunteer with the Irish Project for Syrian Refugees, come over here and help shoot them, also for women autonomy. So yes, personally, I have. Not asking me all about, you know, part of my speeches, but this is something I have discussed in length, and I've discussed what I can do better as a white woman, and well, white perceived woman, in intersectional feminism to make sure that I'm not taking up space for people more deserving in terms of that discussion.
Opposition to respond.
For this specific debate, I consulted Jay Store about half an hour ago. I also consulted Foreign Policy Magazine. Wikipedia. I didn't consult any people. I consulted a lot of awful magazines.
I wrote this speech at 4 in the morning, so no.
So, no, I'm afraid I didn't consult anyone.
Right, great. I will take...
No.
Oh, is this
my God.
That's so threatening.
No, I'm not going to take it anymore because James has lost the sword, so we'll have a vote on... That's what I'm doing. The vote on speaker ability, which is on speaker ability.
40 votes for the
proposition. Dermot Hamill, return to your seat. Return to your seat. If you think this side has spoken best, it's a nice bit, you can raise your hand now.
Oh my God. That's West Belfast, more North Korea.
If you think the opposition is looking best, it's nice.
1, 2, 3, 4.
If you're an Alliance member, you can raise your hand now.
I'm not Alliance,
but
like I have to.
You have to, yeah.
You're breathing,
buddy. No, I don't like,
three. It's,
I'll do it, but that's just my idea, but.
Yeah, but it works.
Do you, what was the op?
Four.
Four. It's 28-4-2. 28-4-2. Quiet, please.
So, there were 28 votes for the opposition. 4 votes for the opposition. Apparently, 2 people sat there and were like,
what
am I listening to here? And I completely agree with you on that.
So the proposition has it. Well done, everyone.